Today is Tuesday, April 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. What lessons have American doctors learned from fighting COVID-19?
We all wished, for the sake of people, that we had recognized that this was coming earlier.
Plus, how smartphone apps may help in the fight against the coronavirus's spread.
Something like digital contact tracing, I think, could make a huge impact.
And how the pandemic may affect 350,000 internally displaced people in Myanmar. Those stories and more next. Around the world, the number of confirmed cases of COVID-19 continues to climb. The latest tally from Johns Hopkins University puts the total number of people who have contracted the coronavirus at over 3 million. In addition, the head of the Japan Medical Association said on Tuesday it will be difficult for the country to host the rescheduled Olympics next year without a coronavirus vaccine available. Multiple countries are working on developing vaccines, but experts have cautioned the process to test the safety and effectiveness of vaccine candidates, plus manufacturing doses, could take 12 to 18 months. The coronavirus outbreak has prompted governments to put billions of people under various stay-at-home orders and tell non-essential businesses to close their doors. As American doctors fight one of the world's worst outbreaks of COVID-19, several are reflecting on what they wish they had known when they first began to fight the pandemic. VOA's Mariama Diallo reports on the lessons learned as the number of U.S. deaths continues to rise.
With the U.S. accounting for nearly one-third of global coronavirus cases, some doctors in the United States say they've learned a lot on the front lines of the battle against the disease. That includes a better understanding of how to help patients who come in with low oxygen, for example, says the medical director of the Mount Sinai Hospital Emergency Department.
What we saw early on is that as soon as somebody started to get, to 6 liters of oxygen on this nasal cannula, they just got worse and worse, and so we jumped to intubation. Now we're realizing that probably something in between for some patients, like putting them on that high flow oxygen or putting them on that BiPAP, may actually be okay for some. The other thing that we've learned is that actually you can prone people.
Proning is a method of lying patients on their belly that has been successful, explains another internist and critical care cardiologist at Columbia University Medical Center.
The theory is that the lungs are like a sponge, and if you lie on your back for a very long time, that gravity sort of pulls all the secretions and the fluid and mats down that part of the lung, and that by flipping people over, you free up that space in the front of the torso to allow the lungs to open and expand and give better oxygenation, and it works.
She also says hospitals ran short of key equipment, something hospitals in Italy, Spain, and other hotspots have also experienced.
We all wished, for the sake of people, that we had recognized that this was coming earlier, could have had things in place for hospitals to manage patients, probably could have prevented a lot of the mass amounts of people that came in all at once, had more PPE available so that people weren't without it.
Internist Dr. Anju Goel says the most surprising has been how the virus affects the elderly.
What I did not recognize was the severity of illness that would be seen in patients who are older. Had we known that, we could have instituted more restrictive control measures to prevent exposure to that group, and also to get very early treatment for that group to try to prevent the complications.
For most people, the disease causes mild symptoms such as fever and cough. For some, especially older adults and people with existing health problems, it can cause more severe illness, including pneumonia, and can lead to death. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
Communities in the United States and around the world are talking about when and how to ease lockdown measures as they grapple with the COVID-19 pandemic. This disease and how it spreads presents some unique challenges. People without symptoms can infect others, and for some, it can be deadly. What if a smartphone application could let you know if you've been exposed? VOA's Michelle Quinn has that story.
Communities around the world have slowed the spread of the coronavirus by locking down society. But there is fear the virus will begin to spread again once those restrictions are lifted. Ranud Dhillon, a doctor, worked in Guinea in West Africa during the Ebola crisis. He helped find people who had encountered a sick person, a practice known as contact tracing.
But certainly with Ebola, as soon as somebody had symptoms, they would, you know, we would try to recreate where they've been, who they've been around. Based upon that, we would then be able to make a list of people who were contacts. And we'd follow those contacts for Ebola for 21 days.
COVID-19 presents challenges to tracing contacts. Some never have symptoms. Others can spread the disease for a day or two before showing symptoms. But what if you could digitally trace people who have been exposed? Apple, Google, and others are looking into using smartphones to inform those who have crossed paths with an infected person.
Something like digital contact tracing, I think, could make a huge impact in terms of automating the process of identifying who's around somebody for those periods of time.
Some countries have been using cell phone apps to trace people who might be sick. This proposal relies on Bluetooth, a radio signal built into phones to connect to other devices, like headphones. It is constantly emitting and listening to signals, a long string of numbers. Maybe once a day, the phone will do an exposure check. Contact a server to see if one of the beacons you received came from someone who tested positive for the coronavirus. But will it work and be accurate? Mark Zisman is with the Massachusetts Institute of Technology's Lincoln Laboratory, which has worked on missile defense and laser communication to the moon. He and his colleagues are testing how to measure the energy emitted from these Bluetooth beacons so that digital contact tracing works.
When these chirps, when these Bluetooth signals go between the phones, you measure how much energy is received, and you use that in part. It's not the only thing you use, but you use that in part to try to estimate how far apart you are.
MIT is working to test how best to measure signals in a variety of situations. Bluetooth signals pass through walls, for example.
Was it free space between us, or were there things, you know, whatever? Was there a mask? Was there a wall? Was there a piece of glass? Were we facing different directions altogether? I mean, you know, what those things all matter. And so we got to measure that too, and that's really hard.
In the model Apple, Google, and others are proposing, no name is shared, no location is shared. The beacon data lives on the person's phone, making it less of a target to hackers than if government health authorities stored the data. Of course, the phone in your pocket isn't going to tell you whether you're carrying the virus, but digital contact tracing might play an important role as society opens. Michelle Quinn, VOA News, Oakland, California.
Some non-essential businesses in New Zealand will be allowed to reopen as the government prepares to ease part of its lockdown restrictions after claiming to have successfully contained community spread of COVID-19. The country's alert level has diminished from 4 to 3. Phil Mercer reports the construction industry will reopen, but parents are urged not to send their children to school.
Builders, carry out restaurants and real estate agents are now allowed to reopen as New Zealand gradually emerges from its month-long COVID-19 shutdown. Some 400,000 people are expected to return to work. It is a cautious reopening designed to boost the economy. Forestry and manufacturing have also resumed, but gyms, hairdressers and other businesses will stay closed. Schools have reopened, but the government wants the majority of children to learn from home. Most New Zealanders will still have to remain at home at all times and avoid all social interactions. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern is warning against complacency.
I want to begin by stressing that at Alert Level 3 we are not out of the woods. It is a recovery room of sorts, to assess if the incredible work that New Zealanders have done at level four to break the virus's chain of transmission and prevent further community outbreak has worked.
Police will be on patrol to prevent people from gathering in larger groups. New Zealand is a South Pacific island nation of about 5 million people. The government has warned that unemployment will rise before it improves because of its coronavirus restrictions. New Zealand's disease control measures have been among the toughest in the world. It closed its borders when it only had a few dozen cases, ordered a strict lockdown of businesses and households, and started a widespread testing and contact tracing regime. For a 10th consecutive day, new COVID-19 cases have been in single digits. The outbreak may have been contained, but addressing fears of further infections, a New Zealand infectious diseases expert warned there were still some smouldering ashes out there, and it has the potential to become a wildfire. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
In Myanmar, an estimated 350,000 internally displaced persons, or IDPs, live in crowded and sometimes unsanitary conditions where they face the danger of a widespread outbreak of COVID-19. Special teams are forming in some IDP camps to help provide information and some equipment to prevent a disaster as the country comes to grip with the pandemic. Steve Sanford has the details.
In Myanmar's IDP camps, access to food, aid, and information has become increasingly difficult as travel restrictions increase. Here in Kachin State, longtime camp residents who earn a living from casual labor say they have a lot more to worry about than the virus itself.
We aren't afraid to get the virus Corona 19 because the most important and dangerous thing for us is the money needed for our family's food supply. If we are shut out of food, we will all die.
Food is in short supply, and so is information about the coronavirus. To help camp residents better understand the highly contagious virus, a media group has produced a video with a special message.
We can check, like, the IDP people, do they have enough information about COVID-19 or not? Mm. And the second thing is, even the IDP children understand about the COVID-19 and then why don't we?
The IDP camps were formed when civilians fled fighting between government forces and ethnic armed groups, a conflict that continues in Arakan and Karen states. In the biggest IDP camp of Etuta, vital rice supplies from Thailand have halted since the border closure in March, putting the camp in danger of running out of food.
The UN country team in Myanmar has to get really forceful with the government of Myanmar and say, look, you know, this is life and death. It's time to end these restrictions and let people get the assistance in there that needs to be reaching these people.
As Myanmar braces for a possible outbreak of the deadly virus, civil society groups are calling for more aid for those in the ethnic areas, since they are among the most vulnerable to COVID-19. Steve Sanford for VOA News in Krabi, Thailand.
And coming up later...
Well, I think one lesson of both the coronavirus crisis and the climate crisis is that we need to listen seriously to the warnings given to us by scientists.
This is VOA News.
Make a difference by honoring ordinary people doing extraordinary things to help one another. VOA encourages you to tell us about everyday people who have shown leadership in your communities during the coronavirus crisis. Submit your nominations to VOA Leaders at voanews.com. Send us your name, phone number, and email, and a VOA reporter will contact you. We're all in this together.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The United States Africa Command has released a report in which it says two civilians were killed in recent operations that it reviewed. I spoke with VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb via Microsoft Teams to get the details.
Basically, what Africa Command decided to do is it decided to go through all of the strikes from February 2019 to March 31st of this year. And so when they went through all of those strikes, there was a total of 91 of them. From there to now, they did find that there was one strike last February where two civilians were killed. About three others were wounded. And this strike was actually intended to target al-Shabaab fighters and actually did kill al-Shabaab fighters in addition to these two civilians. But they did say that they were regrettably unintentionally killed was the wording that they used. And the command, the commander of AFRICOM said that he wanted to place a focus on increasing transparency. And so he said, we came up short. And we admit it when we come up short. So the command went through a total of 20 allegations of civilian casualties, and they were able to close those. However, there are still some open, including one that VOA actually presented to the command. February 24th of this year in Jilib, we have been told, our VOA Somali service was told by the Somali telecommunication company, Harmood Telecom, that one of their employees was killed, and they claimed that that employee was not involved in al-Shabaab. So they're still working on that allegation.
You mentioned that AFRICOM wanted to be more transparent. To what ends are they planning to do that?
Well, they are planning to issue a report every quarter of the year. So they plan on going through all the allegations that they receive, or as many as they can receive, and looking into these allegations. They already do that on their own, but if they get additional allegations outside of their own reporting, they look into those as well. This is something that Amnesty International has called a welcome glimmer of transparency. I don't know if they were trying to be tongue-in-cheek when they said glimmer of transparency, because they have said for a decade that this AFRICOM has been having deadly military operations. They have encouraged AFRICOM to offer reparations to the family of these two civilian victims. And they also asked the commander to look into the strikes earlier than the report, because as I told you, the report only focused on February 1st, 2019 to March 31st of this year. They want them to go further back because they say that there are more civilians that were killed further back. AFRICOM has denied this.
Carla Babb is VOA's Pentagon correspondent. The International Maritime Bureau reports an increase in the number of attacks during 2020's first quarter off the coast of West Africa. I spoke with Paris-based reporter Nicolas Pinot via WhatsApp to learn more.
Yes, Gulf of Guinea has emerged as a global hotspot, accounting for 21 attacks so far this year and 90% of all kidnappings at sea in 2019. So obviously, it's in the waters of Nigeria and most attacks in Nigerian waters. And what we have to mention is that the number of crew kidnapped in this Gulf of Guinea climbed 50% to 121 in 2019. It's very important, for example, because Gulf of Guinea has surpassed now the Strait of Malacca, which separates Malaysia and Singapore. And right now, it's a really hot spot. And all companies in the world, they really be careful when they send crews to ship oil in the region.
What recommendations is the International Maritime Bureau making?
Well, they are very worried about the situation, especially with the dramatic decrease of oil price right now in the world. So they think that the pirates, they're going to have a tendency to attack more tankers, because right now you don't have enough space on the continent to be able to keep all the oil which has not been sold on the market. So the International Maritime Bureau is very worried about right now new attacks on oil containers regarding the current situation. And they're especially worried for waters of Togo, Benin, Cameroon, Gabon, Equatorial Guinea, and lesser extent Ghana. And they think that right now this is the hotspot for piracy in the world.
So, Nico, what can you tell us about the difference in the way that the pirates are operating between, say, those in off the coast of Somalia and Guinea?
Well, I think it's interesting to mention that unlike what's happening in Somalia, pirates in the Gulf of Guinea, they don't have safe harbors to be able to keep prisoners and hostages like their Somalians. Counterparts may have, like their Somali counterparts may have in the region. And I think most of the trade take place within a few days after the size of the ship, because they don't have nowhere to hide. And I think that's the major point and the major difference between the different pirates on the African continent.
Nicolas Pinault is a journalist based in Paris, France. The personal and societal threat posed by the coronavirus pandemic everywhere in the world is dramatic and undeniable. However, scientists say suffering caused by COVID-19 may be just a mild preview of what climate change may bring in the coming decades, especially in Africa. To compare and contrast the two, one immediate and the other on a slower burn, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke by Zoom with Columbia University's Michael Girard, professor of environmental law at Columbia University's Law School and director of the university's Sabin Center for Climate Change Law.
Well, I think one lesson of both the coronavirus crisis and the climate crisis is that we need to listen seriously to the warnings given to us by scientists, to do everything we can to reduce the hazards that they are telling us may happen, and to prepare to cope with the negative impacts that may happen regardless of our best efforts.
You told me that this isn't just a scientific question for you.
Well, I have a little granddaughter who was born in 2018, and I worry a great deal about what kind of world she is going to grow up in. And the reaction by a number of countries, especially the U.S., to the coronavirus is making me even more worried.
What are some of the future effects of climate change that really keep you up at night?
For instance, there are going to be parts of the world experiencing extreme heat, so bad that you can't really survive long outside, even in the shade. You have to go in for air conditioning, and if you don't have air conditioning, you're really in trouble.
And of course, we expect a drastic rise in sea levels, which has already begun.
That's right. One of the almost certain impacts that climate change will have is a large increase in the number of people who can no longer live where they've been living because of sea level rise, and they'll need to move. We may have hundreds of thousands or even millions, or under some projections, tens of millions of people who will need to move away from their traditional homeland. And where are they going to go? Who will let them in? Are the developed countries, including the U.S., going to just erect walls and machine gun nests, or are they going to show their humanity and let some people in?
What's the outlook for Africa specifically?
Africa is one of the parts of the world that is most vulnerable to the impacts of climate change. Extreme heat, drought, desertification, sea level rise along the coastlines. The current locust swarms may have been worsened by changes in climate. And of course, Africa is also the continent that has the lowest amount of surplus economic capacity to deal with all of these problems. It's also an area of the world that is likely to face rapid population growth. So the combination of all of these things creates very, very serious problems.
How do you compare the experience of the coronavirus threat with the even greater threat the severe climate change has for us down the road?
One would think that it is easier in one sense for society to deal with the coronavirus because it's an immediate problem that is right there. Climate change tends to be more remote in time, but both of them show the shortcomings in the ability of many societies around the world to deal with threatened hazards. A similarity is that the climate crisis is in large part because we have such a interconnected and economically vibrant world and economies that have grown up around very heavy use of fossil fuels to move people and goods all around the world. Now, that has had very good impacts in lifting many people around the world out of poverty, but on the other hand, it has led to tremendous greenhouse gas emissions, which are going to endanger everyone. Likewise, if we still had a disconnected society, a virus like this would have stayed put. But because everybody is moving around the world all the time, the virus spreads globally. So that's another similarity between the two crises.
Do you think the coronavirus pandemic will actually be a real climate change wake-up call for the Earth's people and their leaders especially?
Well, I'd like to believe that, but we've seen the distressing partisan divisions even over the coronavirus. We had hoped that this kind of crisis would bring people together, but it seems to be continuing to drive us apart.
Any parting words of advice for us?
I think the most important thing is really listen closely to the scientists. Don't let the politicians get ahead of the scientists. Listen to what the scientists have to say and act on it.
Michael Girard is a professor of environmental law at Columbia University Law School. He was speaking to our own Adam Phillips. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.